This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of July 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 91st edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. That big old yellow roller in the sky, this gorgeous English summer sun, for there is one, is making us a little reminiscent. We're getting a Proustian rush for childhood summers. We're kind of looking at memory today. For one, we're remembering Amy Winehouse. A new show at London's Jewish Museum takes a look at the family side of the wonderful singer.
She was, as this exhibition suggests, a kind of nice Jewish girl who talked and talked and talked and talked. And it brings that aspect of her out.
And we're remembering with fondness a small but iconic thing. New York's Met Museum is doing away with its admission tickets, ever styled as lapel pins. Too expensive and too metal, they say. We say, boo.
I'm definitely going to miss them. I feel like it is a symbol of one of the greatest museums in the city.
And if the heart is a place to store memory of love and loss, then Amanda Palmer, our musical guest, wears hers right on her sleeve and has it tattooed underneath too.
I just like whatever works for you, I'm so happy for you. If you are crying at Barry Manilow or Coldplay or Frank Sinatra or Justin Bieber or what have you, as long as you're being emotionally moved in some way, I don't care.
And we'll get arty in Beirut, jazzy in Montreal, and snatch a minute of sound from a crazy big Jesus march in São Paulo. We'll also, frankly, be getting a lovely suntan during our lunch break. That's all here for you on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. First of all, a track from this week's live Midori House session from Amanda Palmer. Amanda's a kind of legend, formerly of the Dresden Dolls, now a solo performer who mixes cabaret, spoken word, a bit of performance art, and a freight train of attitude and very intelligent songwriting. Amanda is currently on a world tour, and she stopped by Midori House to give us a little sample. First up, here she is with Ukulele.
Sid Vicious played a four-string Fender bass guitar and couldn't sing, and everybody hated him except the ones who loved him. A ukulele has four strings, but Sid did not play ukulele. He did smack and probably killed his girlfriend Nancy Spungen. If only Sid had had a ukulele, maybe he would have been happy. Maybe he would not have suffered such a sad end. He maybe would have not done all that heroin. Instead, he maybe would have sat around just singing nice songs to his girlfriend. So play your favorite cover song, especially if the words are wrong. 'Cause even if your grades are bad, it doesn't mean you're failing. Do your homework with a fork and eat your Fruit Loops in the dark and bring your Etch-a-Sketch to work and play your ukulele. Ukulele small and fearful, ukulele brave and peaceful. You can play the ukulele too, it is painfully simple. Play your ukulele loudly, play your ukulele badly. Ukulele banish evil, ukulele save the people. Ukulele gleaming golden from the top of every steeple. Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks, then gave her father 41. It left a tragic puzzle. If only they had given her an instrument, those Puritans had lost the plot completely. See what happens when you muzzle a person's creativity and do not let them sing and scream. And nowadays it's worse because kids have automatic handguns. It takes about an hour to teach someone to play the ukulele, about the same to teach someone to build a standard pipe bomb. You do the math. So play your favorite cover song, especially if the words are wrong. 'Cause even if your grades are bad, it doesn't mean you're failing. Do your homework with a fork and eat your Fruit Loops in the dark and bring your flask of Jack to work and play your ukulele. ukulele thing of wonder, ukulele wand of thunder. You can play the ukulele too in London and down under. Play NSYNC and play Jacques Brel and Eminem and Neutral Milk. Tell the children, crush the hatred, play your ukulele naked. If anybody tries to steal your ukulele, let them take it. Imagine there's no music. Imagine there are no songs. Imagine that John Lennon wasn't shot in front of his apartment. Now imagine if John Lennon had composed Imagine for the ukulele. Maybe people would have truly got the message. You may think my approach is simple-minded and naive, like if you want to change the world, then why not quit and feed the hungry? But people for millennia have needed music to survive, and that is why I promised John that I will not feel guilty. So play your favorite Beatles song and make the subway fall in love. They're only 1995, that isn't lots of money. Play until the sun comes up and play until your fingers suffer. Play LCD sound system songs on your ukulele. Quit the bitching on your blog and stop pretending art is hard. Just limit yourself to 3 chords and do not practice daily. You'll minimize some stranger's sadness with a piece of wood and plastic. Holy fuck, it's so fantastic playing ukulele. Eat your homework with a fork and do your Fruit Loops in the dark and bring your Etch-a-Sketch to work, your flask of Jack, your vibrator, your fear of heights, your Nikon lens, your mom and dad, your disco stick, your soundtrack to Karate Kid, your Ginsu knives, your rosary, your new Rebecca Black CD, your favorite room, your Bowie knife, your stuffed giraffe, your new glass eye, your sousaphone, your breakfast tea, your Nick Drake tapes, your Giving Tree, your ice cream truck, your missing wife, your will to live, your urge to cry. Remember, we're all gonna die. So play your ukulele. Thank you very much.
That was Amanda Palmer with the loquacious ukulele. And we'll hear more of those narrative wonders from Amanda later on in the show. It's been nearly 2 years since pop music global superstar Amy Winehouse was found dead at her apartment in Camden, North London. 2013 would have been her 30th birthday. During her short-lived career, her name was often emblazoned in the headlines and pages of the British tabloid press, and not always for the right reasons. But her music spoke to millions around the world, winning her 6 Grammys, 3 Ivor Novello Awards, a Brit Award and the Mercury Music Prize, among numerous other nominations and accolades. On top of that, she was also a style icon, her unique beehived 60s-inspired look being picked up by the likes of Chanel and French Vogue. An exhibition about the singer has just opened in Camden at London's Jewish Museum. Curated partly by her brother Alex, it contains photographs and personal items owned by Amy, most of which are being shown for the first time, and seeks to explore another side to her identity not always lived in the limelight. We dispatched producer Katie to find out more.
The abundance of international press crammed into this small room on the top floor of London's Jewish Museum says so much about Amy Winehouse, a character who lived her life in the spotlight and who, even in death, continues to fascinate. It's a tiny but brightly lit space, no bigger than a small gig venue, filled with short-skirted outfits from various performances and events, posters and photos, her eclectic record and CD collections, and an assortment of brightly coloured lanyards and tickets hoarded from festivals and gigs. But there's also a Jewish cookbook, Family Trees, an old school jumper. Curator Liz Selby shows me the battered suitcase which sits in front of you when you enter the exhibition. It's crammed full of old photographs of Amy and her family.
I think there's a real poignancy to the object because Amy was looking through the photographs just before she died, and she actually called her dad to come and look through them with her, and that was the last time her dad actually saw her. is full of photographs that Amy held on to, even though some of them aren't particularly well taken. Some of them are incredibly blurry, but it doesn't look like she ever threw anything out. So I think they were obviously very important to her.
And it strikes me a bit that this suitcase is a microcosm of the exhibition itself, trying to distill a life into a small space.
Yeah.
How did you curate this?
Well, Amy's brother and sister-in-law, Reva, came to us originally because they felt that they wanted to offer us something to put on display, and originally it was a dress. We talked to them and we got to know a bit more about Amy and about the objects they had. We realised that the exhibition was much more about her family life and about her roots and what she was like as a person. But you're so far away.
Doesn't anybody stay in one place anymore? There's no mention in this exhibition of the drink and drugs that Amy Winehouse became infamous for. Nor do you hear her music. The soundtrack is about her world, taken from a playlist she made when she was about 14, titled Songs on My Chill Out Tape. We learn about Amy's grandmother, Cynthia, a strong and colourful character who Amy looked up to. Cynthia once dated jazz musician Ronnie Scott. Adorning the walls are quotes from Amy's successful application for a much-coveted scholarship at the Sylvia Young Theatre School in London. One of them reads, "All my life I have been loud, to the point of being told to shut up. The only reason I've had to be this loud is because you have to scream to be heard in my family." John Azlewood is a music critic for the London Evening Standard. He interviewed Amy at several points during her career.
There's a sort of posthumous notion that she was this tragic figure who couldn't string a sentence together, who was tottering around on these high heels. And when you spoke to her, particularly in the early days, particularly when it was just starting to happen for her, she wasn't like that at all. She was, as this exhibition suggests, a kind of nice Jewish girl who talked and talked and talked and talked. And it brings that aspect of her out.
Amy's brother Alex helped Liz curate the exhibition. His written thoughts act as signposts as you walk round.
I think he was very keen to show Amy as a person, but a person within a family. And he says in the introduction to the exhibition that Amy was the most famous person in the family, but she wasn't the centre of it. And that's very true. We get to see Amy as a well-rounded person who is very aware of her heritage and her roots. And I think that's something that people will be kind of quite surprised by.
Though Amy Winehouse's Jewish heritage may not have informed her music, it was certainly a huge part of her identity. It's a theme that the exhibition is keen to explore, as Abigail Morris, CEO of the Jewish Museum, explains.
I think it's very important because I think it's part of the private Amy that people didn't know about, and I think that's very much what this family is. It's an intimate and private thing. But I also think it's really interesting because I think she exemplifies so many traits that are common to so many Jews in this country, coming over at the end of the 19th century, that mass migration, going to the East End, then moving out to the suburbs. But also that thing of feeling very strongly Jewish, identifying very strongly, having traditional Friday nights, brother bar mitzvah, going to Jewish school, but it not being the most dominant thing about you.
For John Azlewood, exploring this other side of Amy's life is key to the exhibition's success.
As with all dead pop stars, she's preserved in this kind of aspect of a 28-year-old woman. Amy Winehouse will never get old, and the fascination with her will never die. It's not so much about keeping the myth alive. The music will do that for her. But it is important that although drugs and drink were a huge part of her life, that she's not just remembered as someone who fell by the wayside because of her personal demons.
This isn't the kind of show that strikes you with the monolithic power of David Bowie at the V&A. It's just a small thing, slightly sugar-coated, but deeply personal too. And it helps to deal with the illusion so often conjured by celebrity culture, that we actually know something about the person we idolise, when in fact, we only see what's projected into the public gaze. For Monocle in London, I'm Katie Bilboa.
Thanks, Katie. And if you're in London and want to visit Amy Winehouse, A Family Portrait, it's on at London's Jewish Museum until the 15th of September. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Up next, we'll hear how it's all changed at the Met in New York.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're heading now to the Big Apple. New Yorkers liked to leave them pinned to their collar when they rode the subway back downtown. Tourists kept them for years in scrapbooks or coin jars. Children even made artworks out of them. The Metropolitan Museum of Art's metal admission tags were impeccably designed and became iconic cultural symbols, copied by many other institutions over their 42 years of existence. So when New York's biggest museum announced recently it would stop issuing the buttons, art lovers across the city were shocked by the decision. We dispatched Pauline Eiferman to get the public reaction at the Met and find out about this romantic fascination.
Let's see here. So starting with this dark purple, we have Barney. We have light purple, which is Joker. We have Nephrite, which is teal. We have Kia, which is light green. My favorite one is Hubba Bubba, which is kind of a hot pink color. We have Piglet, which is a light pink color. Juniper is dark green. Rodeo is a bright red. Firefly is the bright yellow. They have really, Poupon is the dark yellow. They have really, really fun names. I have the entire collection multiple times over.
I'm definitely going to miss them. I'm surprised that this is happening. I kind of wish that I knew so I could get one last tag. I'm definitely going to miss them. I feel like it is a symbol of one of the greatest museums in the city.
When all this hubbub erupted, I did a little research about tin. And they say that the world supply of tin is going to be depleted somewhere between 20 and 40 years from now. So, you know, I really see no reason that a one-time visit to a museum, you need to have a metal tag on you.
My name is Mark Rosen. I am a museum educator, and we are at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. I also give private tours here at the Met, so I have a very deep relationship with this place.
And so today you brought us all 16 colors of the tag, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I brought you all 16. From what I know, they started using these in 1971, and previously they had these really huge tickets that would rip in half. So started using these, and then have just as of, this past Monday, switched to using stickers. Because it's totally, you know, a situation. If you're a museum in the 21st century, especially like the Met, and you have, I think there's a projected almost 7 million people coming to the museum this year, it's hard to be able to keep those people coming through the door when you have these little metal pieces that tend to fall off as well, to give them. So the stickers are the right move to make, but it's really sad to see these little guys go.
So what do you think these tags represent to different New Yorkers, to tourists, to art lovers? Does everyone have their own kind of symbolism attached to it?
I would imagine so. I always tell people I am really, really jealous of you if you grew up going to the Met, because I did not, coming from a very small town in Texas. So yeah, I can even imagine. I haven't really talked to someone about what it was like to, you know, have one of these from when you were five visiting the Met, but those people definitely exist. And I think if you're a native New Yorker, you definitely have a really strong association with these. I've only been here for a year, but having, you know, a degree in museum studies, this is like the most iconic little button in the world, I would say, for a museum. So,
when the Met started issuing these, it kind of started a trend all over the world. Some other museums started doing the same. What do you think a museum gains from having such an iconic tag?
I just feel like everyone that comes, this is why postcards are so popular in museums, because everybody wants a little takeaway, a little token to remember the experience by. And I think, you know, stickers work well, postcards work well, but there's something about, this isn't paper, this is metal. You know, it's shiny, it's small, it feels precious in a way. So I feel like there are probably a few things that could rival how nostalgic and kind of special this feels, but I feel like the little metal buttons have a little extra personality somehow compared to something like a postcard or a sticker.
some people have kind of criticized the Met for not putting the money in, saving these buttons. Gosh. What would you say to them?
Let's get a donor. Let's get someone behind this. Yeah, if only. Or maybe, you know what? Let it simmer for a few years. Try the stickers out. And if they don't work and someone wants to sponsor this, then bring them back, because then you will have an even more epic following, I think.
But you're still in a lucky position that you're a member and they still give buttons to members.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a matter of until they run out or what, but for the time being, at least, if you are a member of the museum, you come in, you get your button.
And what are you going to do with the buttons? Frame them? Keep them?
Okay. No, wait for that. So I have said time and time again, I am either making some sort of a really obnoxious brooch or pin out of them to wear on tours, or like a Technicolor blazer or something. Like, I know these things are not staying in a jar. They're definitely going to be put on display, because now, you know, security won't be confused why people are wearing buttons, because they're used to seeing the stickers. So no, I'm going to go to town. There's going to be something to look forward to for sure.
That was museum educator and Met Tabs obsessive Mark Rosen talking to Pauline Eifman in New York. Still to come in part two, we'll enjoy some more of the wonderful Amanda Palmer and her Midori House session. We'll get the critical reaction to a new exhibition reviewing Lebanon's modernist art movement. We'll ask what Montreal Jazz Festival is doing for the city's battered public image. And we'll take to the streets with a million Paulistas in our Minute of Sound. Don't say we don't treat you, because we're doing just that. It's culture, and it's right here on Monocle 24. So here she is again, Amanda Palmer, swung by this week from Midori House session. We talked performance, how to write, where to do it, and where the fire comes from. First, she rocked us with The Killing Type.
I wouldn't kill to win a war. I don't care what they do it for. It's all so terribly vague. I see the pictures from a thousand years of battle, and I think it's such a bore. I walk New Orleans with a knife, like Mackie hidden out of sight. But I'd be useless if they jumped. I'm really not the killing type. I'm not the killing type. I'm not. I've got a picture of your mum before the war when she was young. She's got an etching to her right. I think it's funny that she's looking to the left, and it's a sign I wouldn't kill to get you back. I've officially been asked. I wouldn't kill to save a life. I'd rather die a peaceful piece of shit, bait, shame-filled coward. Thanks, I'm not the killing type. I'm not the killing type. I'm not the killing type. I would kill to make you feel. I don't mean kiss someone for real. I couldn't do that, it's wrong. But I could say it in a song, and I'm saying it now. I'm saying it, so even if you never hear the song, somebody else will know. I'm saying it now. I'm saying it, so even if you never hear the song, somebody else will know. And I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't discover when slipped on a dying bed. It was a mercy killing. I couldn't sleep for a week. I kept feeling it's breaking bones. I heard that if you see a star at night and the conditions are just right, and you are standing on a cliff, then you can close your eyes and make a wish and take a step and change somebody. I'm not the killing type. I'm not the killing type. I'm not the killing type. I'm not, but I would kill to make you feel. like you to move your face an inch. Oh, I see you staring into space. Oh, I wanna stick my fist into your mouth and twist your arctic. Yes, I would kill to make you feel. Come and kiss someone for real. I couldn't do that, it is wrong. But I can say it in a song. A song, a song. And I'm saying it, now I'm saying it. So even if you never hear some somebody else will know. I'm saying it, now I'm saying it. So even if you never hear the song I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't explain how good it feels. I just can't describe. I'm not the killing type.
Amanda Palmer, thank you so much for your Midori House session.
Thanks.
Is it tough to get intense at lunchtime? I don't want to cheat our listeners and pretend this happened live at 7 o'clock one night.
It actually is. This is the first thing that I've done since landing in London last night. So you don't really know what's going to happen. You open your mouth up in the morning and sometimes interesting things come out. That first song was pretty interesting.
I think when you get halfway through an amazingly intense song, a lyrically rich song, a piano banging song, subtlety.
Yeah.
Plus piano banging. And then halfway through the song, just announce the crowd, I've got jet lag, let's restart. And no one's noticed a thing. I think that you're kicking off on the right foot, right?
You do enough performances and you realize that you don't have to always just suffer through things. You're allowed to stop and start over in certain cases. I do that at shows, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm pretty well known for, you know, screwing up a song a couple minutes in and just sort of stopping and looking around and saying, Let's just do this one again.
Do people, is it, it's like, because you know how audiences sometimes get more nervous than performers, right? It's a good icebreaker for people, isn't it?
It's a fantastic icebreaker, and it reminds people that you're not a television. It reminds people that you're actually a human being on a stage doing a thing.
But there needs to be a bit of vulnerability. I think some of your songs, there needs to be a bit of vulnerability in the playing of them. Some people go on stage and they have such a slick product. Well, you're going to put that word in inverted commas because we hate it, right?
But I don't think you can put Amanda Palmer and Slick in the same
Slick, but some performers have a Slick product and they write songs that are meant to break your heart but don't because their rendition of their own words that they maybe have cried their eyes out at 3 o'clock in the morning in their attic writing it. I'm basically putting all these people like Coldplay and an artist, Garrett, when they've never been
Coldplay.
In one. But you know what I mean? They write these beautiful, quite beautiful songs and yet you can't actually believe that they've lived the life that is borne out by these records.
But I think a lot of people do believe Coldplay.
I'm not having a go at Coldplay. I'm just saying.
Well, or
for
the Coldplay-esque.
E.g. Coldplay. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there can be a different kind of power. And I mean, the thing about a band like Coldplay or whatever, you know, music that's sort of written to be giant and they know they're going to play it in arenas. I think it really just is, you know, like different strokes for different kinds of audiences and musicians. And
I like the way you didn't say folks then.
What did I say?
Different strokes for different sorts of people and audiences and markets.
Exactly.
Okay.
I didn't want to head into the cliche.
Don't do
I'm
that.
Trying to prove myself as a good songwriter.
Don't let it rhyme.
But seriously, I mean, if there are one thing that I've learned, and I as a teenager listening to music, I was so judgmental. I really couldn't believe that certain people were moved by certain music. And nowadays, I just like whatever works for you. I'm so happy for you. If you are crying at Barry Manilow or an old friend, you know, or Coldplay or Frank Sinatra or Justin Bieber or what have you, as long as you're being emotionally moved in some way, I don't care.
Power to you.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I'm just happy for you.
Because of the lyrical heart of your music is so strong and there's such poetry in it. Does it matter where you play it? Do people have to speak English? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it definitely works better in English-speaking countries or countries that are pretty English-friendly. But not totally. You'd be surprised. Like, I have a big fan base in Brazil.
Yeah.
And, you know, I have a big fan base in, you know, where I'm hitting Paris and Luxembourg and Austria on this tour. And my fan base in Austria
is hitting Luxembourg.
We're going to hit Luxembourg. Yeah. We're going to party. but it is very songwritery.
Yeah.
You know, it's not dance music, and if you're missing the lyrics, you're kind of you're missing the bulk of it.
Yeah.
So, but you know, it still works really well in, you know, the fact that my audience in Austria is as big as my audience in, you know, or bigger than my audience in Birmingham or Manchester speaks a lot about, you know, the ability.
I thought you were going to say something about command of the English language. You're going to skate over that. Amanda Palmer and the Grand Theft Orchestra. The record is called Theatre is Evil. It's out now. Mm-hmm. And it's eminently catchable on LP and live as well. Amanda Palmer, thank you so much.
And it's free on the internet.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, it's free on my website.
Why are you doing that? Because I wanted, before we go, we should ask you one question about this. The internet is your friend. You're one of the people that's harnessed it and made it work for you.
Oh, it is.
You've bent it double over a barrel, haven't you? You've got it in a headlock.
It's actually, it's fighting back in its own way. The internet is a very love-hate subject for me right now. But yeah, I mean, I use a lot of internet tools to connect with my audience, and I love it. And I think, I don't know if I'm always going to do it this way, but I took a you know, just to experiment, totally free release of the record with Pay What You Want. And it's been interesting to see how people deal with it.
That was Amanda Palmer talking to me there. You can buy her album, Theatre is Evil, from her website. Pay whatever you like for it. And she's currently on a world tour in the UK this week, and then you'll find her further afield. Just visit amandapalmer.net for more information. And you're tuned into Culture with me, Robert Bound. Right, we move to Lebanon to explore a new exhibition which has just opened in Beirut. The country's modernist art movement received a sudden boost of attention with the recent exhibition of Salwa Rawda Chuker at the Tate Modern in London. Yet it remains an otherwise relatively unexplored period. Journeys Through Our Heritage is a new exhibition in the nation's capital which aims to revisit these works through the eyes of Lebanon's contemporary young artists. Venetia Rainey coupled up with renowned Lebanese critic César Namour to see what the end result was.
Sitting in a giant, shiny box in Beirut's waterfront district are some 20 pieces of art, ranging from video installations and photographs to larger-than-life cloth monsters and Perspex mountain ranges. Journeys Through Our Heritage opened last week at Beirut Exhibition Centre. The idea behind the exhibition was a simple one. Curators Janine Mamari and Marie Toom asked 20 of Lebanon's Civil War generation artists to create something informed by the country's pre-1930 modernists. César Namour, one of the country's few actual art critics, grew up in a world shaped by the modernist movement in Lebanon. He is one of the people behind the newly opened Modern and Contemporary Art Museum nestled up in the hills of Mount Lebanon, and as such, has a particular interest in the way the gap between the two generations of artists is bridged. We snuck in to have a peek at the exhibition ahead of the preview night. The gallery was completely empty, apart from Maria Kazoun, who was putting the finishing touches to her 5-meter-high hybrid beast.
You're looking at a creature that's made out of a fabric piece that I designed. It was sponsored by Rubelli, the oldest fabric company in Venice. They designed 20 meters of this fabric that I used here. It's all silk. The piece here dialogues with the work of Salwa Rawda Chuker. She had made these pieces based on the arch, the line, the trajectory of these elements.
Because there are lines and threads and arms and tentacles everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I usually do. This is how I found affinities with her work, because this is what my work looks like, really.
So what did Namour make of Kazoun's work?
She selected the most avant-garde of that period that she worked on with the plexi and the glass and the plastic threads. And this is not really the typical work of Salwa Rawda Chuker. She selected things that goes along with her temperament and her style of work. So actually, she has not really absorbed the actual elements of the work of Salwa Rawda Chuker.
In another part of the gallery, our attention was drawn to a life-sized corrugated metal cutout of a woman doubled up, her arms cradling her head defensively, one foot pointing to the floor. Next to it was the 1916 charcoal drawing by Khalil Gibran, which Abdul Rahman Katanani had used as his jumping-off point.
So here it is exactly the reproduction of a drawing by Gibran. This is corrugated steel. You know, these metal sheets are used in the small huts of the very poor in the suburbs of Beirut. And here, using this this material in his work, also tries to convey the sadness and the misery which Gibran, Khalil Gibran, tried to convey in his drawing.
Why was it so sad? Was this just after his sister or mother had died?
Yeah, yes, that's right.
On the opposite wall, Khalil Salibi's self-portrait, unfinished, from 1928, depicts a stern-looking man in purples, greens, and with a face turned sharply toward the audience. Now, the idea is, here, that they have a painting by Khalil Salibi,
yeah,
and they will have three artists, art students, painting it during the exhibition.
Oh, I see.
So it's a sort of live reproduction.
I see, okay.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of that?
I think it's a very nice exercise, performance actually, by young artist trying to convey an old master of Lebanese impressionist painters.
Who was Khalil Salibi? He looks very stern in this painting.
Yeah, he was a very stern, very conservative person. Yeah, he was the first impressionist in Lebanon, and a whole group of artists after him followed him. He was an excellent painter, one of our best, actually.
Other works on show included a set of photos inspired by painter Helen Khal's capturing of light and colour, neon and perspex riffs on the theme of mountains and Saliba Dwehi's use of colour fields, and a mural trilogy depicting elements of three modernists in the cloaks of three macabre-looking women. It is an engaging exhibition with a huge diversity of works, providing plenty to talk about. But for Namur, a self-confessed dinosaur of the Lebanese art scene, there was still something missing.
I thought I would see my generation. I didn't see him in my eyes here. I see them in the eyes of the new generation, which actually not related to my generation. There's a big gap. And here where I have been in through the last few years, been trying to fill up the gap and document my generation so that in the future, this present generation will appreciate fully the golden age of the 60s and 70s that Beirut had.
Do you think it's been appreciated?
No. No, I feel that they were very selective about what aspect of the work of the old generation to work on. So all of them, or most of them, they selected a very limited aspect of their works. But now I can see, you know, even with selecting a limited aspect in the works of the ancients, bring some understanding.
And while journeys through our heritage may not push for the total understanding Namur would like, it does offer a refreshing and unexpected day trip into the world of Lebanon's forgotten modernists. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
And you can catch Journeys Through Our Heritage, Revisiting Modern Lebanese Artists at the Beirut Exhibition Centre. That's on until the 4th of August. You're tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll be getting jazzy in Montreal.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. The 34th edition of the Montreal International Jazz Festival has just wrapped up, with 3,000 artists from 30 countries and more than 650 concerts spread across 20 indoor and outdoor venues. It's the biggest jazz gathering in the world. This time around, however, the festival happened in the midst of political scandals just weeks after the city's mayor resigned in the wake of corruption charges. But can cultural events like the festival help Montreal rebuild its image? We dispatched our Toronto bureau chief, Nelly Gotcheva, to find out. Between some gigs by the likes of Christabel, Nikki Yanovsky and Feist, she found the time to chat with programme director Laurent Saunier.
I have to go back at the beginning, because at the beginning it was a really small festival. There was only something like, I don't know, maybe 20, 25 concerts, something like that. But something like 30 years ago, the festival moves to downtown Montreal. There's some streets close to the automobiles and all that stuff. So it's really in the heart of the city. Now it's called Quartier des Spectacles, but 30 years ago, it was only downtown Montreal. At the beginning, the founder of the festival, Alain Simard, told everybody that this festival site is a kind of ideal village where there's no race, there's no religion, there's harmony, peace between everybody. And I think we achieved this part. During those 30 years, there's not a single major incident during the jazz festival, on the site of the jazz festival. And I think this is really part of the reputation of Montreal all over the world, to be a safe place. It's strange to say that, but you know, when you want to travel with your kids and all that stuff, you're looking for that kind of destination where it's safe to go outdoor at night, etc., etc. So we achieved that kind of ideal village. Montreal has a lot of problems. Those times around with corruptions, it's our third mayor in 6 months or something like that, and there will be election at the beginning of November, so we will have another new one, etc., etc. So those times are quite difficult for the city of Montreal. But I think the image that the festival gives to Montreal is kind of welcome, because there's a lot of people that are dropping by Montreal at that time of the year, and mainly because in our festival dates, there's the Canada Day, which is July 1st, and Independence Day, 4th of July. So there's a lot of people coming from other parts of Canada, from the northeast of the United States, especially, etc., etc. And there's a lot of people, there's a lot of tourism from all over the world, but it's mainly from those two places. The reputation of the festival is bigger than the reputation of the city. You know what I mean?
I'm DJ Champion.
You are from Montreal, or you've been living here for quite a long time now. So how does the city transform during the jazz festival? What is the spirit like?
Well, it's the whole summer. You know, we have the Francophonie, and I'm gonna be missing a few ones, but you know, the Francophonie, Just for Laughs, and Jazz Fest. It's a city that comes alive so much in the summer, and you see that. I was in Helsinki a few years ago, and I saw the same kind of thing happen, because in the winter it's cold, people stay inside, and when springtime comes, you know, people come alive, the ladies get small dresses, and the boys go crazy. And so that happened here in Montreal, and plus with the festivals. I love it because you don't have to go out, you just come here. You know, you don't have to plan anything. Just come in the area downtown, and you have something going on. That's perfect. I think that's the best way to use a city. Not by telling people where to go, but just where to meet. Nothing has to be planned. You just come down here and have a good time your way.
And speaking of the best ways to use the city, Montreal Jazz Fest is the biggest international jazz festival in the world. So there are a lot of international musicians coming here. I'm sure that tourism is also blossoming around this time. Given the news lately about, you know, the city problems that you guys had, do you think that festivals, like especially international festivals like Montreal Jazz Fest, are actually helping and contributing to rebuild an image of a city.
Of course, that is drastic. This king of France was very big on, commissioning music and art and poetry and plays, because his view was, you're gonna come to see me and you will see how wealthy I am. And he was showing his wealth with art. That has been going on for years. That's nothing new, and this festival is what it is. It makes the city looks good, and it's perfect.
That was local jazz luminary DJ Champion talking to Nelly Gotcheva at last week's jazz festival in Montreal for this here culture show on Monocle 24. Well, we've still got one more track to come from Amanda Palmer, but first we've got a minute to fill, so we might as well do it well. Over 1 million people came out to take part in the recent Jesus March in São Paulo. Former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva made it a national celebration in 2009, and it's taken place every year in the city ever since. Brazil is one of the most religious nations on earth, boasting the highest number of Catholic worshippers in terms of population, with a growing evangelical population too. We're keen to hear what 1 million people out on the streets sounds like. Sheena Rossiter went out and gathered us this minute of sound. That was a minute of sound from the Jesus March in São Paulo, courtesy of Sheena Rossiter. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be enjoying a session from Nit Jam Rosie, taking a trip around the world, courtesy of Giles Peterson. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer is Katie Bilboa. Holly Fisher is back from Glastonbury in one piece and pulled it all together again. As always, feel free to get in touch. rb@monocle.com is me. kb@monocle.com is Katie. That's where you'll find us. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session. This is Amanda Palmer and her beautiful track, The Bed Song. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in.
Exhibit A, we are friends in a sleeping bag, splitting the heat. We have one filthy pillow to share, and your lips are in my hair. Someone upstairs has a rat that we laughed at, and people are drinking and singing about Scarborough Fair on a ukulele tear. Exhibit B, well, we found an apartment. It's not much to look at, a futon on a floor, torn off desktop for a door. All the decor's made of milk crates and duct tape, and if we have sex, they can hear us through the floor. But we don't do that anymore. I lay there wondering, what is the matter? Is this a matter of worse or of better? You took the blanket, so I took the bedsheet, but I would have held you if you'd only let me. Exhibit C, look how quaint and how quiet and private Our paychecks have bought us a condo in town. It's the nicest flat around. You picked a mattress and had it delivered, and I walked upstairs, and the sight of it made my heart pound. And I wrapped my arms around me, and I stood there wondering, what is the matter? Is this a matter of worse or of better? You walked right past me and straightened the covers, but I would still love you if you wanted a lover. And you said all the money in the world won't buy a bed so big and wide to guarantee that you don't accidentally touch me. Exhibit D, now we're both mostly paralyzed. Don't know how long we've been lying here in fear. Too afraid to even feel. I find my glasses and you turn the light out. Roll off on your side like you've rolled away for years. Holding back those king-size tears. And I still don't ask you, what is the matter? Is this a matter of worse or of better? You take the heart failure, I'll take the cancer. I've long stopped wondering why you don't answer. Exhibit E, you can certainly see how fulfilling a life from the cost and size of stone of our final resting home. We got some nice ones right under a cherry tree, you and me lying the only way we know. Side by side and still and cold. And I finally ask you, what was the matter? Was it a matter of worse or of better? You stretch your arms out and finally face me. You say, I would have told you if you'd only asked me. If you'd only asked me, if you'd only asked me.